Welcome to the Sunstone Magazine podcast, where you get the best of Mormon thought and experience in a succinct package. I'm Stephen Carter. This segment is entitled 13 Favorable Consequences of Ordaining Women by M. Scott Fisher. At the time of this article's publication in August 1995, M. Scott Fisher was a consulting psychologist in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He and his wife Marjorie England Fisher were the parents of four children. Introduction. Growing up as an active male in the LDS Church, I have been comforted by knowing I could invoke the priesthood to bless my child. Every parent and every child deserves that same comfort. The winter Edna Corn Arrington was pregnant with her fourth child, the 1918-1919 influenza epidemic struck Twin Falls County, Idaho hard. The entire family was stricken. One daughter died, the father hovered between life and death, and the baby, a 1.5-year-old boy, contracted pneumonia on top of the flu. The overworked doctor told Brother Arrington that the child could not live more than 24 hours, and warned Sister Arrington not to expend her little remaining strength in trying to save him. Pregnant women were particularly susceptible to the killing disease. Acting in love and faith, Sister Arrington and Hannah Bowen, a Relief Society volunteer nurse who had recently moved there from Tooele, Utah, anointed and blessed the infant, as they had been taught to do in their Relief Society. He was Leonard J. Arrington, later LDS Church historian. Two generations later, another mother, married to an inactive priesthood holder, woke to find her son, who suffered severe croup attacks, struggling to breathe. She carried him into the bathroom and turned on the shower, hoping the steam would help, while someone called the ambulance. But the steam wasn't helping, and he was turning blue. Quote, "My son was sitting on the toilet seat, and I sat in front of him on the bathtub edge. Suddenly, in a natural, instantaneous response, I laid my hands on his head and said, 'As your mother, I call upon the power of the Melchizedek priesthood,' and I blessed him. I had always prayed desperately for him during these attacks, but this was the first time I had ever laid my hands on him and invoked the priesthood. While I was speaking, his head slipped forward from under my hands and fell on my lap. He was asleep." Unquote. Growing up as an active male in the LDS Church, I have been comforted by knowing that in similar situations, I could invoke the priesthood to bless my child. Every parent and every child deserves that same comfort. We feel the joy and relief of the mother with the asthmatic child. Each of us who has heard Leonard Arrington speak, read his works, or been influenced by the historians he has trained, feels the poignancy of the doctor's dismissiveness and the strength of Edna Arrington and Hannah Bowen. However, only 20.9% of Mormon families in the United States fit the traditional profile of a temple-married couple with children in the home. And even in such homes, many husbands are absent on business or in the service. The benefits of equal access to priesthood blessings by hundreds of thousands of women and children, who are as deserving as those in homes with active priesthood holders, become even more apparent in light of these statistics. Yet, empowering Mormon mothers to act authoritatively in calling down blessings of health on their children is only one of the positive consequences of women's ordination to the priesthood. As I have thought soberly and realistically about this controversial and sensitive topic, I've seen many ways in which women's ordination would positively influence individuals, the church, and even the world. I regret that this topic is controversial and seen by many as the domain of women and general authorities. The issue of ordination concerns men as much as women. Men obviously have the power to do something about it. And, less obviously, have much to gain from the change. A personal odyssey. I have come to believe that it is important to state what I genuinely feel, think, and see. For many years, I thought little about the issue of women's ordination. When I did, I dismissed the topic quickly as one of balance. Did not God assign priesthood to men so that they could develop the gifts that women had naturally? The turning point came when I responded to an invitation to write an article on the use of authority in church settings. When I began thinking systematically about priesthood, I realized I could not defend the exclusion of women from such authority. Men and women are too tightly woven together in life's tapestry. It was a paradigm shift. The benefits of ordaining women to the priesthood overwhelmed me. I've spent the intervening months reading widely on related topics, discussing the matter intensively with thoughtful people both in and out of the church, and making it a matter of private meditation and prayer. My first insight has been consistently and repeatedly confirmed. Continued study and contemplation have yielded only greater clarity and certainty. I gain more peace daily regarding the positive consequences of women's ordination. Why am I sharing this private inspiration? Two experiences illustrate my motivations. In my Detroit ward in the 1960s, an African-American brother served as Sunday school secretary. He worked on his records while the rest of us went to priesthood meeting. I became uncomfortable walking past him every Sunday morning on the way to my high priest group. I genuinely yearned for his full participation as a brother in all aspects of the church, but especially in priesthood meeting. So I determined, along with a friend who felt as I did, to write a letter to church leaders expressing our feelings and respectfully requesting a change in policy. But I never wrote that letter. When I mentioned the idea to my father, he said it would be crazy to write such a letter. I was working for the church educational system at the time, and I simply lost my nerve. When I related this experience to a general authority a couple of years later, but prior to the 1978 revelation, I wondered aloud if such a letter could have done any good. He said, "It might have." In the second experience, Elder Bruce R. McConkie, then a member of the First Council of the 70, endeared himself to me forever when he spoke at the Salt Lake Institute in 1966 and cited an Old Testament story that had escaped my attention. When Moses was meeting with the 70 elders he had chosen, they prophesied under the influence of the Spirit. Two of their number were still in the camp, not with Moses, but the Spirit also touched them, and they prophesied. When a young man came running in with the news, Joshua exclaimed, quote, "Moses, my Lord, stop them," unquote. The record continues, quote, "But Moses replied, 'Are you jealous for my sake? I wish that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit on them," unquote. The message of Brother McConkie's remarks was that we should all speak as we are moved to do so. I also note now and appreciate the fact that Moses said, at least in this English translation, quote, "all the Lord's people," unquote, not "all the Lord's men." I now see my earlier hesitation as insensitivity and a lack of courage. In this essay, I say what I think and see and feel according to how I have been touched about making God's blessings available to all of his children, daughters and sons. 13 positive consequences of ordaining women to the priesthood. The list that follows comes from my observations and experiences as a husband and father, an active church member with many callings, including leadership capacities, and my work as a consulting psychologist, trying to maximize the effectiveness and personal growth of individuals and groups. Number 1, organizational equality. The first and greatest advantage of ordaining women to the priesthood is to make them structurally equal with men in exercising priesthood authority, equal in growth opportunities, and equal in access to administrative offices in the church. The Book of Mormon tells us emphatically, quote, all are alike unto God, unquote, and then categorizes the most obvious groups of differentiated humanity to stress that God sees no such differences. Quote, black and white, bond and free, male and female, unquote. God is concerned with fairness and justice, and hence with equality. Equality is an irreducible value. The most powerful mechanism the church has to make women equal to men is to give them the voice of priesthood authority. After Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her bus seat triggered a 2-month bus boycott, negotiations for a compromise slowly bared the unacceptable assumptions underlying segregated seating. It became evident to the organizers that the solution did not lie in negotiating more seats for blacks, or finding answers to questions like, what if a black man sat next to a white woman and their knees touched? Instead, they decided to press for an end to discriminatory seating laws. When people were given their basic rights, the freedom of equality, then the principle was simple. People could sit anywhere there was a seat. We might ask, what would it be like if anyone could give a blessing, be a bishop, or be primary president? I think it would be like it was in Jesus' church. A change of policy would not change attitudes in the church overnight, any more than attitudes in Montgomery, Alabama changed immediately. But 40 years later, attitudes have changed. In the meantime, those who were discriminated against have increasingly enjoyed the blessings of freedom and the exercise of their basic human rights. Changing the priesthood policy won't suddenly solve all of the problems of discrimination, insult, and abuse that women sometimes receive in the church. Witness the experience of RLDS women. But it will help. Ordination will build a better bridge, over which we can pass to address other structural problems. Meanwhile, it will make all of the gifts accessible to all who might benefit from them. Number 2. Debunking harmful man-made justifications. The ordination of women would eliminate the harmful justifications of exclusion, a pattern that parallels folk beliefs that evolved to justify the exclusion of blacks from the priesthood. A friend, who was both faithful and brilliant, found himself speechless when his 6-year-old asked why she would not be able to hold the priesthood. Painfully, he realized that every answer he thought of but one would send a message of inferiority. The most honest and the most helpful answer he could give her was to say, "We don't know why women can't hold the priesthood." I take particular umbrage at 2 damaging and illogical arguments currently used against ordaining women. The first is the easy formula. Men have priesthood, and women have motherhood. This argument seriously damages men as well as women. It makes either fatherhood or priesthood a consolation prize, and denigrates both. As a father, I would never choose priesthood over fatherhood, nor would I consider priesthood more important than fatherhood. Elder M. Russell Ballard took a valuable small step toward eliminating this equation by pointing out in the General Relief Society meeting on the 25th of September, 1993, that men have, quote, priesthood and the responsibilities of fatherhood, unquote, while women are assigned only, quote, the responsibilities of motherhood, unquote. Still, the fact that many experience pain at this illogical comparison should not go unnoticed. The second damaging and fallacious argument is that the prayer of faith is fully efficacious in healing, Therefore, devout women don't need the priesthood. This argument detracts from our faith that priesthood can be a power in our lives beyond its use in such ordinances as baptism and confirmation. If priesthood is useful for men in calling on the powers of heaven, then it would certainly be useful for women as well. Ordination and eliminating the need for illogical rationalizations could make the priesthood more powerful for all. Number 3. Removing messages of women's inferiority. The ordination of women would lessen, and in some cases eliminate, the message of inferiority frequently sent to women in the church. For example, in one ward, a successful ongoing service program was designed by both men and women. However, the bishop referred to the program in a public meeting as having been developed by the priesthood. When the omission was called to his attention, he promptly corrected himself. More blatantly, women's opinions are dismissed, and they're told that they cannot perceive and interpret facts as well as men. Veda Anderson, a friend and one of the most able people I know, once summarized her experience with men in the church, quote, "I'm always wrong because I am a woman," unquote. Veda holds a PhD in sociology from the University of Michigan and is a former president of the National Kidney Foundation. My experience is consistent with hers. Mormon men frequently do not listen to the ideas of women as seriously as they listen to those of men. And because a woman's leaders are all ultimately male priesthood holders, women are rendered unequal, less powerful, and inferior. Their voices are weakened by this unequal treatment and the separation and injury that it imposes. A friend who is as psychologically healthy as any human being I know says, quote, "I don't have the priesthood because God hasn't revealed it. Maybe it's because I'm not worthy or can't handle it, in God's opinion. God didn't give me the priesthood. I'm inferior in his eyes," unquote. It is the denial itself that is damaging to her. When a woman sees herself as theologically inferior, she will lack strength in social self-assertion. If she wants to assert her opinion, she may hesitate, paralyzed by questions like, "Am I just being selfish? Shouldn't I be more self-sacrificing?" If she yields to such questions, she diminishes her self-esteem by diminishing her voice, and she must deal with the resultant guilt and frustration of her silence herself. In my opinion, buttressed by my professional observations, self-silencing always diminishes self-esteem and increases perceptions of inferiority. In a tragic reversal of the heroic story of Helaman's warriors, who expressed their faith in the words given to them by their mothers, we learn through a Harvard study of adolescence by Lynn Mikkel Brown and Carol Gilligan that American girls are taught to relinquish their voices not by men, but by older women, often by their mothers. The systematic stifling of the female voice in and out of the church produces in me simultaneous feelings of grief and anger. Brown and Gilligan wrote, quote, "It was with a sense of shock and then a deep, knowing sadness that we listened to the voices of the girls tell us that it was the adult women in their lives that provided the models for silencing themselves. We wept. Then we could recall the controlling, silencing women with clarity and rage. But we could also gratefully recall the women who had allowed our disagreement and rambunctiousness in their presence, and who made us feel whole," unquote. The tendency for self-silencing is endemic in the organizations I work with, and no less frequent or less present in church settings. The church could do much to remove this damaging cultural fact of life. That women acquiesce in being silenced is not evidence of a healthy system. Rather, it is evidence of how thoroughly they have been trained, and often damaged, by millennia of unequal treatment. As Gerda Lerner has pointed out, quote, "The structuring of society in such a way that women were for millennia excluded from the creation of the cultural product has more decisively disadvantaged women in their economic and political rights than any other factor," unquote. If women had the priesthood, the absence of women's voices in the decision-making processes at all levels and in leadership handbooks would be ameliorated. Number 4. Better decisions from more perspectives. The church needs the vitality and strength that comes from women's voices. The church would benefit by bringing the gifts of women into the public arena. A substantial body of current research suggests that men and women often speak for different values and perspectives in open discussions. Men tend to focus on the values of separateness, autonomy, status, rules, hierarchy, and accomplishment. Maintaining these institutional markers gives them much of their identity. Women tend to focus on relationships, connectedness, and caregiving. Much of their identity comes through these processes. When there are problems, if we listen to both women and men, we will hear both voices, to the benefit of all. Number 5. Improved gender communication. Women's ordination would help men and women communicate more freely with each other. The problem of gender-related communication is certainly not one on which Mormons have a monopoly, but the rigidity and exclusiveness of Mormon patriarchal structures exacerbate both the cultural manifestations and their consequences. In my work with groups, I have found that unequal status almost always makes communication within the group more difficult and seriously limits the ability of the group to become a cohesive unit. Alice Eagley, writing on gender and social influence, reports differential influence between men and women in the family as a result of the higher status that men ordinarily have in organizations. She quotes psychologist Stanley Milgram, quote, "The individual higher in the hierarchy is believed to have the right to exert influence by virtue of his or her position, and the individual lower in the hierarchy is believed to have the obligation to comply with the demands that are made," unquote. Disadvantaging women in this way has negative effects on the husband-wife relationship and the family. Number 6. Improved marriage partnership. If women were ordained equally, husbands and wives would feel a stronger and sweeter sense of equality in their partnership. We would bless each other more. It's hard for a woman or a man to ask for a blessing when the request bears within it implications of inferiority and dependence. Equality in ordination would also contribute to the quality of parent-child relationships. Wives have not been able to participate freely in giving children parents' blessings. This exclusion has damaged mothers and daughters. What does the daughter sense when her mother can't give her a desired blessing? What does it teach her about her voice, about herself as a woman? The limitation of parental blessings to fathers has, I believed, helped fathers create special bonds with their children. But the inclusion of the mother would not weaken those bonds. How has the present practice contributed to the special bonds between mothers and daughters? Spiritual leadership in the home is a joyful responsibility. Yet, hundreds of men feel burdened and nagged by it. Sharing the burden would draw husband and wife closer together in mutual blessing and would provide a model of equality for their children. Number 7. strengthened single parents. The ordination of women would strengthen the hundreds of thousands of LDS women who are or who will be single parents. Knowing that they can bless their children, dedicate their homes, and ask for revelation, women will feel a reduction in the disorientation, intimidation, fear, and inadequacies that frequently accompany single parenthood. When a woman has felt dependent upon a husband, often a negligent or even an unfaithful one, for spiritual leadership for herself and her children, when she feels that his priesthood provides significant security and protection, then its removal through death or divorce can be bewildering. The message and the injustice belittle and damage the woman. Transferring that dependence to a home teacher or a busy bishop can be humiliating, especially if the woman is somehow blamed in the event of a divorce. Nowhere is our unequal treatment of women more evident than in withholding from single women and mothers the blessing of priesthood. Number 8. Greater recognition of the feminine divine. If women were ordained, both men and women would benefit wonderfully by more readily recognizing and validating aspects of the feminine divine. Women would become more sensitive to their identification with the feminine divine in them. Women's having the priesthood would affirm the partnership of the feminine in the divine, or women's equality in the creative process, and confirm for women their share in the divine nature. I also see ordination as performing the equally valuable function of making men more cognizant of feminine aspects in a divinity, of relating to a heavenly mother, and of accepting feminine aspects in themselves. They can be more fully themselves, accept and increase all positive dimensions of their selves, and be free from the implied and stated superiority that goes with male-only priesthood. What is wanted is not for men and women to be the same, but for men to be both sensitive and strong, and for women to be as strong as they are sensitive. Number 9. Priesthood responsibilities would be shared. Men would also benefit directly from sharing the responsibility for ecclesiastical duties. Although men have benefited psychologically and emotionally from the status and visibility of church leadership, as well as spiritually from broader opportunities to serve, such duties can also weigh heavily as a burden, especially in time spent away from families. Ecclesiastical leadership is an area men and women can share and feel good about. Neither would be usurping, neither would be dominating, as we share in decision-making, question-asking, and answer-knowing. Number 10. Protection against sexual abuse. Ordination would enhance women's ability to protect themselves and their daughters against sexual abuse in the home. Although women's ordination to the priesthood would not stop marital rape, wife battering, or emotional abuse, it would help to eliminate the patriarchal male's rationale. Do what I say. I have the priesthood. It would also, by reducing structural inferiority, make women more assertive and less codependent in abusive situations. In the case of incest and child sexual abuse, the present patriarchal structure leaves young women clearly more vulnerable than young men to seduction and abuse from parents and relatives. If the perpetrator holds a priesthood calling, the victim's powerlessness is increased, and her ability to take steps to stop the abuse is minimized. Shared priesthood would help to change the power relationship from one of inequality and implied inferiority to one in which the priesthood itself would be a force protecting the safety of women and children. Number 11. Fewer cases of ecclesiastical sexual exploitation. Women's ordination would reduce the incidence of sexual exploitation by church officials. Bishops, who are required by policy to conduct searching interviews of the sexual behavior of all the young women in a ward, are constantly exposed to temptations of voyeurism or worse. Not all bishops can resist this temptation, and the more righteous the girl, the more compliant she is likely to be to show her good faith and cooperation. Adult women can also be victimized in interview situations. With women's ordination, the interview process could readily change so that men could conduct the interviews of men, and women could do the same for women. Women, especially young women, should not be expected to go to men with sexual issues. Men who don't see this problem might ask themselves how comfortable they would feel discussing sexual issues with the Relief Society president, or if they would like the young women's president asking their son about his sexual experiences. A couple having marital difficulty could seek counseling from the church authority, male or female, with whom they feel most comfortable. Zion, as well as the home, would be a safer place if women had the priesthood. Number 12. Greater self-esteem among young women. Young women would particularly benefit from priesthood ordination through the increase in feelings of dignity and self-worth. Equality in priesthood ordination would significantly impact the rising rates of inactivity among young Mormon women, now higher than the inactivity rates among young men of the same age. I believe these young women are going elsewhere for what they need. Ordination would communicate, instantly and directly, a powerful message about their value. Ordaining young women to the Aaronic priesthood would reduce sexism, gender stereotypes, and the lack of respect for girls and women evinced by far too many teenaged boys. A young man would have a different attitude toward a young woman if he sat next to her at the sacrament table. Boys would be more likely to stop their callous assertions that they are better than girls, reduce their efforts to subordinate them, and indulge in less sexual objectification. Number 13. An ensign of equality. Women's ordination would provide a divinely inspired model for the world, one that recognizes the full status and worthiness of womanhood. Held up against this standard, a whole range of humiliating, destructive, and debasing cultural practices would be even less defensible. Professional limitations, impingements on speech, genital mutilation, murder, and infanticide are ongoing atrocities. Thousands of women live in physical, mental, and/or spiritual degradation simply because they are female. How can we refuse to take any step that might help to reduce such monstrous evil? A chilling consequence of subjugating women is that men have learned the pleasures of domination. When men can regard their mothers, their wives, and their daughters as inferiors, it is easy for them to subjugate and dehumanize other men and whole groups. I believe that peace between men and nations will first be facilitated by peace, justice, and equality between men and women. This prospect may seem grandiose, but the goals of the restored church have always been large in their purposes, and there is power in a minority. It is thrilling to contemplate the good that could be done if the church could lead the fight for the right to decent life. The church can be a powerful influence beyond what its members indicate, and a message of equality between men and women would greatly expand its message of hope. Mechanisms of change. The ordination of women is more viable than we may realize. How reasonable is it to assume that ordination for Mormon women is a possibility? Despite the current firm resistance of church leadership and much of the membership, I think it is more viable than we may realize. We have a strong theological basis for asserting the equality of all persons and considerable institutional flexibility. The model of the 1978 revelation granting priesthood to all worthy males is a strong one, President Gordon B. Hinckley, speaking at the 1985 women's meeting, suggested such a model. Quote, "All of us rejoice in the enlargement of opportunities for women. Under the law, there are few opportunities afforded to men that are not now also open to women. With this enlargement of opportunity, a few Latter-day Saint women are asking why they are not entitled to hold the priesthood. To that, I can say that only the Lord, through revelation, could alter that situation. He has not done so, so it is profitless for us to speculate and worry about it." Unquote. Although this approach does not encourage members to pray for such a revelation, it doesn't assert that priesthood is denied to women because of their eternal nature or because of eternal law, both positions that would be much harder to modify. If there is the will to change and the goodwill to accommodate the discomfort inherent in any transition, the ordination of women will proceed more smoothly than we may envision. With some trepidation, I sent this manuscript to my wife's selfless and sweet Ronald Reagan Republican conservative mother. She responded, quote, "I'm not comfortable with the idea of women in the clergy, but I guess that's just what I'm used to. It's custom," unquote. And quietly, at the age of 88, she assumes, as she has for all of her adult life, that her temple endowment conferred priesthood upon her. She's not an advocate for women's ordination to the priesthood, but she describes what may be the largest part of the problem: our need to remain within our comfort zone. The dialogue about women and the priesthood has already begun. It is probable, given the time we are in, that it will continue and increase among women, among men, in mixed gender groups, in families, and in councils. I would suggest, first, that all parties try to speak without rhetorical posturing, and second, that we focus on issues rather than on whether we have the right to have issues. As committed members of the church, we have the right to explore our thoughts mutually with any who wish to listen and or participate, quote, "that all may be edified of all," unquote. We should be able to articulate our beliefs without suspicion or criticism. Most of us who have consecrated ourselves and our talents accept our responsibility to be anxiously engaged where the way is not always clear. We belong to a church that believes that any impingement on free speech comes of evil. I hope that discussion will go forward and be respected in that spirit. Gender equality is one of the central issues of our time. It is no less relevant or less important in the church and deserves our most careful attention and discussion. Conclusion. Ordaining women would enhance our relationship with God. The ordination of women would enhance the caring, love, justice, and mercy in our relationships with each other and with God. It would help us all to be more capable of finding deity, of finding deity in each other, and of nurturing the divine within ourselves. Contemplating the issue of women's ordination has had this effect for me, and has been an important step in building my relationship with God. Not only are the benefits of female ordination utterly compelling in benefiting women, but there are also equally compelling consequences for men, for children, for the church, and for the larger community. Epilogue. Some things have changed relative to women's ordination since I originally published this article in 1995. Women are more visible at church conferences, they are officially included more often in ward and state councils, and it is now de rigueur to have a woman offer a prayer at general conference. Also, as Jana Reese's research has indicated, the new generation is very interested in enhancing equality in the church. However, a Pew survey of 2015 finds that a few shy of 10% of women actually want the priesthood, although 75% would want it if their leaders wanted them to have it. But 25% don't want it at all, even if their leaders want them to have it. Perhaps unexpectedly, more men than women are okay with female ordination. These 25%, no matter where their objections stem from, and we must respect their agency in holding these objections, are a lot to deal with if we want our church to be one where faith and love preside. T groups, training groups in interpersonal skills during the 1960s, found that if one person in a group of 10 did not accept the team's basic principles of trust, openness, and honesty, the group's ability to do its work decreased. 2 detractors out of 10 made it impossible for the group to progress at all. Apparently, 25% of our church body is strongly opposed to women's ordination, which makes me wonder, is it the membership of the church that's holding us back from giving women the priesthood, rather than our top leaders, as is often speculated? Is the will of heaven indeed tempered by the readiness of the people? Of course, the only way to find out is to talk about it. The church strives to be all that is hoped for in the kingdom of God. In such a place, shouldn't all of us be able to share our thoughts about important issues without fear of losing God's love or each other's? The new teaching model prescribed for church classes encourages this approach. I hope we will become more skillful at it as the years pass. We all need to practice courageous, carefully executed communication about what underlies our convictions, what values they represent, and how we can integrate new information and contexts. I've kept pretty good tabs on the evolution of women's ordination in the LDS Church. I'm aware of the main players and arguments. But I've found that what moves me most about the subject is the vision of young women at the sacrament table and passing the sacrament. It makes me feel like weeping. In another church, I watched a young mother baptize her 8-year-old son, and I'm still touched by the beauty of it. I wonder, what depth of inner strength our young women would gain from having a seat at the sacrament table and passing the bread and water? Certainly, that inner strength would help them in their exercise of moral leadership in a world that could use it. I don't see the benefit of women's ordination so much in terms of having equal numbers of the sexes in leadership posts. I see it in the dignity of the millions who could walk in equality through their daily lives. I see it in the shared commitment of a marriage of equals. I like the thought of being administered to by my wife as I administer to her. I think that looking across the pillow into the face of my high priestess lover would strengthen my self-esteem more than any personal achievement. When I thought of running this article again, I asked, as I always do when I'm humble enough and it's important enough, should I? I got an answer that surprised me. It will help me if you do. And that voice had a feminine ring to it. That concludes 13 Favorable Consequences of Ordaining Women by M. Scott Fisher. The print version of this article contains many endnotes. That concludes this episode of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Encourage your friends to join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/sunstone. If you would like to further support Sunstone's efforts, visit sunstone.org/donate, where you can make a tax-deductible contribution. We'll be back soon with another installment of the best of Mormon thought and experience. Thanks for listening.